WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Forget the nursery rhyme guide to Christopher Columbus. Tonight, On Point, rediscovering the man, deconstructing the myth, and getting to the bottom of what Columbus Day really commemorates. But first, we begin with a look at Indonesia. Two explosions in the Kuta Beach tourist area in Bali on Saturday left more than 180 people dead and hundreds missing. President Bush attributed responsibility for the attack to the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. I spoke earlier with BBC reporter Jane Corbin, author of Al-Qaeda, the terror network that threatens the world. I asked her if the Bali bombings might herald a new wave of terrorism.
I think it's two things. It's striking at an economic target, but it's also a soft target. It's striking where they can strike. And actually, we have seen a number of indications in past months that Al-Qaeda is heading in this direction. There was a bomb left outside a synagogue in Tunisia a few months back, which killed a number of German tourists who were visiting that synagogue. So it's not the first one that we've seen, but of course, the scale of it, over 200, it's believed, now dead, puts us, I think, in a different league. And I think it's very much that Al-Qaeda always chooses the targets that it knows it can strike through. They did it in East Africa when U.S. embassies used to be far more open. Now they're more protected. They're going for the soft target, which is the bars, the nightclubs, the places where Western people, tourists and businessmen, congregate.
More like a Hamas kind of tactic.
It is much more similar to what we've obviously seen in the West Bank and Gaza and in Israel recently. I think that Al-Qaeda is adept at moving and shifting not only its goals, but its ways of carrying out its intentions. And because they've been denied a base in Afghanistan because of the war on terror that's forced them to scatter to the four winds, they're now bedding down in a number of communities around the world where it's A, hard to detect them, and B, it's impossible, really, to extend security. Indonesia is a country of over 17,000 islands and islets, 35,000 miles of coastline. How do you secure a country like that with the most populous Muslim nation in the world?
And a government that has been pretty much in denial about the depth, the presence of Al-Qaeda-connected or directly Al-Qaeda groups there.
Yes, for a number of months now, the Indonesian authorities have been saying they can't arrest a number of militants, in particular one cleric, who other governments in the region, the Singapore government and the Americans and other Western governments, accuse of having links to Al-Qaeda. The Indonesians said there was a lack of evidence and they couldn't arrest him. We'll see what the picture is now. He himself earlier today made a statement that he believed that America was behind this bombing, patently an absurd comment. And I think we wait to see whether Indonesia now, given the shock that's obviously reverberated through the system, gets tough with some of the militants on its soil. Of course, like many nations, it has to be careful because it risks provoking a backlash from its own population. We've seen this in Pakistan recently, where President Musharraf's actions were very unpopular with certain sections of Pakistani society, and that was reflected in growing support for the Islamic groups in the recent elections. I think that the president of Indonesia has been very much bearing this scenario in mind in a refusal perhaps to get to grips with Al-Qaeda in its presence in Indonesia.
And we're in no doubt about Al-Qaeda. The connection between this group in Indonesia and Al-Qaeda is what?
You have to stop thinking of Al-Qaeda as a group. It's always been an umbrella organization, and it's always been, in a way, more of a movement than a specific group. It changes. It forms new alliances, new allegiances. It has dug in and provided, as it were, link individuals to move between Afghanistan and Islamic groups in a number of countries. Pakistan is one, Indonesia is another. So when you say, is it Al-Qaeda, I think we should sort of stop thinking in the mold that says this is Al-Qaeda and this isn't, and start thinking in terms of the kind of movement that Al-Qaeda has spawned, even increasingly in the wake of the attacks of September the 11th just over a year ago.
There's some speculation here that this attack and others are in some sense in reaction to one or both of the following events, the tapes from bin Laden and his associate last week, and two, the war talk about Iraq. Any sense of that?
Well, I think we've always been concerned that messages put out by members of the top hierarchy of Al-Qaeda could be secret signals, you know, waiting to be picked up by their supporters. I think the tapes that we've seen in recent weeks have not been 100% authenticated. I believe that one of the tapes from Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's deputy, probably is genuine. I'm not sure about the audio tapes purporting to come from bin Laden himself. But I think we know that they use the internet. We know they have means of connecting and they have means of getting messages from one to another. It's certainly not impossible to believe that messages broadcast on Al Jazeera television or through the internet are not somehow a way of communicating. That certainly happened in September the 11th plot. The participants did communicate using the internet with really quite a wide-flung network of followers. That's how they did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The Iraq War talk in the United States, the Congress voting a resolution to support President Bush if he chooses to make war on Iraq, what's the connection between that and this sort of thing? Is this a reaction to that? Or
I certainly know from the sources I have close to the organization that bin Laden in recent weeks and the top hierarchy of Al-Qaeda have been very aware of the potential that Iraq could have for them, creating new recruits for them, creating a backlash in the Muslim world. And there was a sense that they might even be waiting to see how the situation with Iraq panned out in the hopes of gaining new support as a result of it. So I think that Iraq certainly plays in the back of their minds, if not the front. And I think also that there is a sense that perhaps America's eye has been off the ball because of the preparations for Iraq, which have dominated the headlines and the political backrooms in Washington. And maybe Al-Qaeda sees this as their chance to strike back and to draw attention back to themselves.
And also the fact that it happened on an anniversary. This seems to be the anniversary of the attack on the coal in 2000. This is part of their modus operandi, isn't it?
I think it is significant that this attack happened on the anniversary of the coal bombing. It can't be underestimated. The effect of the coal bombing on Al-Qaeda as an organization was immense because there was no reaction from America at the time. They saw it as a huge triumph, and it is an important event that Al-Qaeda people refer to and is always marked, if you like, in the history of the organization. So I think it is significant that we saw this attack in Bali on the anniversary of that attack on the USS Cole in the harbor at Yemen.
Jane Corbin, thank you.
Not at all. Thank you.
Jane Corbin is a reporter for the BBC's news program Panorama. She's also the author of Al-Qaeda, the terror network that threatens the world. She joined us from London. Christopher Columbus loved God, worshipped gold, and died still craving glory. He might or might not be comforted to learn that 510 years after his discovery, his name earns most Americans a day home from work and bargains at the mall. Armed with supreme self-confidence, a charlatan's grasp of science, and navigational skills so poor he swore he was sailing to Asia, Columbus eventually made it to the island we now call San Salvador. He marveled at the beauty, the guilelessness, and generosity of the island's native people, and then he made them slaves. The subjugation, decimation, rape, and plunder that followed didn't make it into most popular histories of Columbus's voyage of discovery. Even today, the divide between Columbus the man and the myth is great. Which is your Columbus? 500 years after the fact, is it fair to tarnish the legend? And how is it that such a quintessential hero of American history has escaped history's unforgiving glare for so long? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of The Last Mariner, an article about Christopher Columbus in the magazine's current issue. Elizabeth Colbert, welcome.
Hi, good evening.
Elizabeth Colbert, when we know that Christopher Columbus was a redhead and an Italian, have we pretty much exhausted the innocent facts about him?
Well, that's probably a little hard on the guy. He was a very gutsy guy. We have to give him that. And he was quite an instinctive mariner. I mean, I think that we have to also acknowledge that he had a brilliant sort of feel for the sea. He went back and forth across the Atlantic 8 times, which and at a time when no one had gone back and forth across the Atlantic. And that's an amazing achievement.
And yet you call your article, and it really a sort of review of some histories of Columbus, you call it the lost mariner, and he was lost in more ways than one. Let's begin with how he was lost geographically, how he proceeded, and what was his theory of crossing the Atlantic.
Well, Columbus, unlike what many of us learned in school, which is really an artifact of a 19th century biography written by Washington Irving, who most Americans these days know as the author of fictional tales, Rip Van Winkle, and Headless Horseman,
right.
Wrote really the first modern biography of Columbus, and he did it. It's actually an interesting story. He was broke. He had lost a lot of money in a South American mining stocks, and there's a collapse in 1827, and he'd sort of lost whatever money he had, and he was broke, and he needed to make some money, and writing this biography was a way to do it, and it was a big hit.
This is Washington Irving.
Yeah. Yes, and he wrote it from Madrid, where he had access to a lot of very important papers about Columbus. So it was based on real documentation, but he took certain liberties, including basically making up the story that Columbus was the first person to insist that the world was round, when in fact everyone really knew that the world was round at that point. It was just basically taken as a given, as it is taken as a given today, and no one would have been able to sail off as the way they had without really basically being secure in that knowledge. What his innovation, as it were, was that he decided that if you looked at various sources, they were wrong, and that really the ocean, people at the time believed there was only one ocean. They called it the Ocean Sea. And if you looked at traditional maps at the time, they were wrong, and really the Ocean Sea was a lot smaller than people thought it was. And he got to this conclusion by various chicanery with the numbers.
He was trying to make a case that he could go around this thing quicker, faster.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly. He said, I can sail west and get east, but in order to convince anyone that this is a practical option, the boats at the time were very small. We don't know exactly how long they were, even though, people have probably seen what purport to be replicas. They were somewhere around the neighborhood of 80 feet long, and they, couldn't make a 10,000-mile journey, which is what at the time, most people believed this ocean stretched halfway across the world. And so he argued, no, that wasn't really true. Land really stretched a lot further than we thought. And if you just went to the west, you would come to China, or really Japan, he thought, in about 2,700 miles. And this is the case that he made first to the King of Portugal, who didn't buy it, and then to the King and Queen of Spain, who also didn't buy it for many years, until finally someone convinced them, well, you don't really have that much to lose, so why don't you give it a try?
And he was off by about, what, 10,000 miles?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But you say everybody believed the Earth was round, but Columbus. He had another shape in mind.
Well, at a certain point, this was already in his third voyage, at which point he got quite far. He got all the way to the coast of Venezuela, and he made some mistaken measurements with his quadrant, which he was using, which was a tool that they used to take latitude, and he didn't get a correct sighting on the North Star, or at least that's what we believe now. And he started to believe that he was going up as opposed to simply going across. And he decided that he was on sort of a knob of the Earth, or a breast-shaped knob, and that if he could get to the top of this knob, that must be where earthly paradise was. And he wrote this, and he was very convinced of it. He wrote it in a letter to the King and Queen, which has been preserved.
Yes, and in that letter he tells of arriving at the earthly paradise, San Salvador, and he said of the people, "They do not bear arms, nor do they know them, for I showed them swords, and out of ignorance they took them by the edge and cut themselves." Quite a resonant scene, given what was to transpire.
Yes, he was very, he writes, rather movingly about meeting these completely innocent people. They were very gentle people, and who had obviously never seen anyone from the West before.
And they were going to see a lot of them. Hang on 1 minute, Elizabeth Colbert, please. We'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're rediscovering Christopher Columbus this hour, reconciling the man with his myth, and 510 years after his voyage of discovery, asking what it means to continue to mark the date. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker, who has an article about Columbus in the current New Yorker. I just quoted his diary entry for October 12th, Christopher Columbus's entry in his diary, in which he speaks with wonder of the beautiful people he met and their grace and their gentleness and their ignorance of swords, touching the blade even and cutting themselves. But then he goes, 2 days later, he writes to Ferdinand and Isabella, quote, "When your highnesses should so command, all of them can be brought to Castile or be kept captive on their own island. For with 50 men, you will keep them all in subjugation and make them do anything you wish." He had found paradise, but he was sort of like the snake, serpent, wasn't he?
Well, that is certainly the way that many people, many historians today would look at it. He was the first Westerner to meet these people, to discover the indigenous people of what would come to be known as the New World, not a term that he coined, certainly, because he always thought he was in the Old World. And he was introduced many of the institutions that really quite horrible, I think we would have to say objectively, quite gruesome and horrible institutions that became sort of a hallmark of Spanish colonialism in the New World, including a system by which settlers were basically granted a piece of land and simply granted all of the native people who were on that land, and those people ended up working for the settlers until really most of them died. There was a tremendous, it's estimated that within about 40 or 50 years of Columbus's arrival on the island of Hispaniola, which is, you know, now home to Haiti and the Dominican Republic, that virtually all of the native people, and some estimate that there were millions of native people, that is a figure that's simply not known, were dead.
All were dead. We're joined now on the line from Los Angeles by Jeffrey Simcox. He's a professor of European history at UCLA and general editor of the Repertorium Columbianum. Did I get that right, Professor Simcox?
Yes, you did.
What is this work, the Repertorium Columbianum? It's the subject of Elizabeth Colbert's article in The New Yorker. Tell us about it.
Well, the series has been going for, well, it started in 1988 and 1989, and it is the publication of the basic documents relating to Columbus's voyages in the original language, that is, in Latin or Italian or Spanish, with English translations, historical introductions, and notes, and so on. So that the text will be available to both academic scholars and the general public.
Now,
and we now have about 12, we're on our 12th volume. We will probably have one more volume, the 13th, to go, and that will probably be the end of the series.
Well, as to what the series says, here's a dialogue between Fidel Castro and Arthur Schlesinger Jr. in 1992, looking ahead to the 500th anniversary. I asked Fidel Castro how he looks on the impending anniversary. He replied, quote, "We are critical. Columbus brought many bad things." I said, "If it weren't for Columbus, you wouldn't be here." Castro replied, "Well, Columbus brought some good things as well as bad." What about that? Good things as well as bad. We've just been talking about him as this knave and slaver and so on. But what was the good of Columbus and what he brought?
Well, this is what historians argue about and will continue to argue about, the good versus the bad.
Mm-hmm.
certainly Columbus didn't intend to bring anything in particular to the Americas. He had a plan for a voyage to trade with the Americas. When he got there, he found that it wasn't Marco Polo's China, as he thought it was going to be. There wasn't the possibility of trade, so he had to rearrange his agenda. And at that point, finding some gold, finding the Taino Indians, who seemed very easy to subjugate, finding a few products on the island, then the whole sense of the mission changed. It became a colony to extract gold, principally, and pretty soon slaves from the island. Now, along with the subjugation of the indigenous people come European diseases, smallpox particularly, which ravaged the entire indigenous population of the Americas. And in fact, even today in the remote Amazon, smallpox attacks isolated pockets of indigenous people because they have no resistance to it. So Columbus, in one sense, integrated the Americas into world history. Mm-hmm. What he did in 1492 is enormously important. The consequences of it, however, are in many senses catastrophic. They were catastrophic for the indigenous people. And we debate that down to the present day.
Yes, we do. And I have as I shuffle through my papers here, I have a question that Mario Vargas Llosa asked in 1992. He said, what would America be like today if the dominant cultures were those of the Aztecs and the Incas? What's the answer to that?
Good question. You know, I have to say that certainly the Aztecs were a brutal imperialist people, too. Mm. When the Spaniards meet the Aztecs, it's a diamond cutting a diamond. Mm. However, what has to be said is that they were the people there. It was their land. They were in possession. The Spaniards took by force from them what was already theirs. Perhaps, who knows, by now Aztec civilization would have evolved into something altogether more humane. But, this is one of the great imponderables. We have no way of knowing.
And, of course, it was famous for the obsidian knife and the sacrifice and the plucking of hearts out of people and so on. How important was Columbus's faith, just simply his faith in himself, but also in the Christianizing aspect of his mission?
Well, I think it's important later on. One of the myths that circulates about Columbus is, that I encounter when I'm teaching this to students all the time, is that he came with the idea of bringing Christianity to a continent where it was unknown. And that just is not true. The original voyages were trade and colonization. And it isn't until later on, until the third voyage, that he starts to get into this kind of mystical interpretation of his, that he is a man sent from God to spread the faith and so on. This is partly a way of justifying his mission to himself and to the Spanish crown, because by that point, things were going very wrong already on the island that he had discovered, and the Spanish crown was very critical of him, and he had to look around for new reasons to justify what he had done. In his later years, yes, he reconstrues the mission as bringing the light of Christianity to these unchristian peoples. But that's not what it was originally about. As to his faith in himself, he had an incredible, stubborn belief that he was right. Mm. So he dies thinking that he had found Asia in the face of mounting evidence that it certainly was not Asia. That, I think, is what kept him going on these voyages, the idea that, yes, he was right, and all his critics were wrong.
Mm. And, of course, no one could say, wait a minute, you found something more important than Asia. You found
America. At the time, it didn't seem that way.
Didn't seem that way, of course.
No, I mean, these are islands with very little gold.
Right.
Some indigenous people who die off in huge numbers. You can't even enslave them. They die. I mean, from the Spanish crown's point of view, this was really not a very winning proposition. The Portuguese, who had just rounded the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean, found this wonderful ocean with trade routes and pepper and spices and gold and textiles. If you asked anybody in Europe in the early 16th century who got the better deal, the Portuguese certainly did. Until the Spanish conquest of the mainland, of Mexico and Peru, and the opening up of silver mines there and the discovery of huge, large areas of settled agrarian civilization, clearly from judging by, you know, comparison to Portuguese and the Spaniards, the Portuguese had done much better.
Yes, yes. Elizabeth Colbert, you write that a sentence that sounds hopeful. You say he was, it appears, this is at Columbus, at the end of his life, he wrote something called the Book of Privileges. And perhaps you can tell us about that. But you write that he was well aware of the toll that colonization had taken on the Taino. These are the native people. Toward the end of his life, he complained that he'd heard that 6 out of every 7 natives in Hispaniola had died since his departure. Well, that sounds like he's repenting.
Well, except as you read on, this is all related, I should add, by his sort of earliest sort of biographer, who is a very interesting figure in his own right. And he relates that Christopher Columbus, as he was nearing the end, complained bitterly about the death toll on the Taino, but he was really concerned because this was the basis of his own income, his own revenues. He felt that the island of Hispaniola should be giving him a lot more, the trade with that island, and should be giving him a lot more revenues, according to the original agreement he'd had with the Spanish crown, and that the fact that these people, the workforce, basically kept dying off was really cutting into his income.
So this was the it was a sort of financial regret rather than any moral facing up to what he had done.
At least as related by Las Casas, yes.
Mm-hmm. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about Christopher Columbus, the man and the myth, and asking what you were taught about Columbus and how do you reconcile what you were taught with what we now know. Jack is on the line. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, how you doing?
Well, fine.
Great program.
Thank you.
I just want to make a comment about, I work in the Northeast out of Brown University in archaeology and other kinds of historical inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, archaeology is only 100 years old itself, so we get a lot of new perspective on traditional things from that.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that seems to be emerging for me about Columbus over time as a scholar is that the people came over each had a different degree of ethnocentrism about them. We know that the Vikings were plying the transatlantic for about 500 years before Columbus. We know this from all kinds of evidence, right?
Had they made a mainland landing? Had they landed on the continent of America?
Up in Newfoundland, up in Nova Scotia and so forth. Yes, there's all kinds of archaeology that will tell you that now. And this is, again, several hundred years before Columbus. And anybody who was plying the seas then, they learned by what other people had done. They followed the traditional things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But my quick point is this. In 1450, before Columbus, 42 years, the Pope, Nicholas declared that all, quote, unknown peoples may hereby be enslaved to our prophet. And I kid you not, that is his language. They don't even quite know yet who's over the hill because the Portuguese are upset about trade routes in Africa and so forth, and he's settling a squabble. So he defines all unknown peoples as profitable. Conversion is just a cover for that. And all I'm saying is Columbus brought over that degree of ethnocentrism. The Vikings, there were Scotch Templar knights in New England in 1398. If you come to Newport, Rhode Island today, you'll see Newport Tower that's been there since then.
Mm-hmm.
So we know Columbus was following other people, but he brought his own intensity of ethnocentrism. And you'll see the same later, because in that same transatlantic culture that was going on between very ancient native peoples and many Europeans, the pilgrims entered that milieu and brought their intense biblical ethnocentrism and caused tragedy. And you know what they did? A preemptive strike that killed a group of native people in 1623. And then we have later settlers that do very well here with the same native people. It's their methods that matter.
And it's presumably what they carry in their heads. Hang on the line, Jack. What about that, Professor Jeffrey Simcox? What about this papal bull, or whatever it was, that essentially said, hey, if you can get him, you can convert him or make him slaves?
It may be true. I haven't seen the document. But this is a point of canon law that was very much debated, and although the Pope might have issued that, there were plenty of theologians at the time who disagreed with it. And the great Spanish school of theologians of the 16th century, who operated from the University of Salamanca, debated this issue and came to the conclusion that the Pope did not have the right to give away rights like that over other peoples. That the principle of natural law operated in the relations between Christians and non-Christians and had to be obeyed. So I would not take that as a categorical statement. I would take it as a position taken by the Pope at a particular moment, but very much disputed by all sorts of theological authorities.
Yeah, and I can remember years ago looking into this and reading a book called Aristotle and the American Indians.
Exactly, Lewis Hankey, yes.
Now, what did that book argue?
Well, it's about the debate over how are the Spaniards going to treat these people that they have now conquered. First of all, are they human?
And that was where Aristotle came in.
Right. Yeah. And then is there the doctrine of natural slavery that Aristotle postulates, which applies to them?
Mm-hmm.
And the great theologians, the Dominican theologians in 16th century Spain, notably Vitoria, arrived at the conclusion that, yes, they were human. Yes, you had to treat them like fellow human beings. You could not automatically enslave them. Perhaps under certain conditions, this might be possible, some theologians said, for instance, in a just war, but otherwise, no. So what starts as a result of Columbus is this huge debate about the relations between Europe and the non-European world, which
and
still goes on.
Indeed it does. Thank you, Jack. Bill is on the line. Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening.
You started off by asking, what exactly are we celebrating? Why can't we just simply celebrate what the man was, both the warts, the good points, the bad points, whatever? If he was involved in the slave trade, let's point that out. If he was considering himself to be an agent of Christianity, let's point that out. If he had courage, let's point that out. It's easy to judge people from hindsight. But one of the things, you know, judging Columbus, warts and all, saying, my God, the evil aspect of this particular man, you have to take it in terms of what the world was at that particular time. Slavery was a major portion of the economy and was a major portion of the American economy going well into the 1800s, even in New England. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, for me, Columbus, I'm not looking for a saint. I want to know the truth, period. That's it. I want to know the evil the man did, but I also want to know the good that the man did. Let's face it, what he did was a major achievement.
Indeed. As that dialogue with Castro points out, yes, we're here because of him. Yes, I guess the question is then, do we judge him anachronistically, or were there people in his own world who judged him the same way? We're going to get back to that after the break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about Christopher Columbus, the man, the myth, and the meaning of his discovery.
From Boston,
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about Christopher Columbus this hour. Who is the Columbus that you discovered as a child, and how does he fit with the bloodstained Columbus of revisionist history? Do we do a disservice to him by debunking his myth? And if it's true that his legacy is one of savagery and subjugation, what does it mean to commemorate Columbus Day? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Elizabeth Kohlberg, just before the break, Bill raised the question of anachronism. We're being tough on Columbus here. We're using words like atrocity and subjugation and on the verge of saying genocide. Were there people in his own world who judged him just as harshly?
Well, I think as Professor Simcox pointed out, there was a tremendous and he's certainly way more of an authority than I, but there was a debate at the time, and Bartolomé de las Casas, whom I referred to before, who wrote a history that's sort of considered the first biography of Columbus, is very, very hard on Columbus. He describes an incident that occurred during Columbus's second voyage as the beginning of what we would of genocide, really, and he doesn't mince words. I mean, he talks about what was to become a river of blood, and he spent his life trying to argue and protect the indigenous people. Obviously, he failed at that.
He was a Dominican priest.
He became a priest. He had come over, in fact, as a slaveholder himself, as a settler, basically, but experienced what he described as a conversion several years later.
Mm-hmm.
And he, so just as one person, and there were obviously many, who deplored, and in fact Columbus, in fact the king and queen were telling Columbus, you know, they didn't want slaves from the New World. But he was, as Professor Shinglass also pointed out, he sort of needed an economic rationale for this voyage, which had sort of turned into a bit of a debacle by this point.
Mm-hmm. And you even point out that they sent a knight out there, Isabel and Fernand did, to arrest him and send him back, partly for his sanguinary excesses.
Well, they didn't send him to arrest him. However, when he got to the island, he found that Columbus had sort of summarily executed seven people, and he used that as a excuse, if you want, or rationale, or he just was outraged by it, and so he basically had him arrested and sent back.
So he returns to Spain in chains.
Yes, that's a bit of theatricality on Columbus's part. To a certain point, he probably could have dispensed with the chains, but he sort of wanted that to show how terribly wronged he had been.
Mm-hmm. Jay is on the line. Hello, welcome.
Hi, great program.
Thank you.
But I think I have a comment and then a question.
Yes, sir.
The comment is that, you know, I think thinking about kind of weighing up the good and the bad with regard to Columbus is like a chicken and an egg, you know.
Yep.
It depends on whether you take a Eurocentric view of history or whether you don't. It's almost like a parallel debate would be like the British colonial occupation of India. I mean, was it a good thing or a bad thing? Well, the British brought railways and industrialization to India, but it sucked the life blood out of India.
Mm.
So right now, you know, India has industrialization as a consequence of colonial expansion, but also it is also very poor because of that. So it's a question of whether you take a Eurocentric view. From the Eurocentric view, yes, it discovered the Americas, and America primarily became a Eurocentric entity. But on the other hand, if you ask native peoples, and from if you look at the civilization from their point of view, it's not such a good thing.
Mm. Okay. The anthropologist Jorge Claude de Alva once speculated, this is according to Arthur Schlesinger, that America, if Columbus hadn't come, might be something like contemporary India, a mixture of religions, languages, and castes, somehow extracting coherence out of incoherence. Does that sound resonate with you at all?
Well, India is kind of a product of both its own long ancient history as well as its colonial legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this country.
Yeah. You know,
so is this country. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of the answer is probably a shade of gray. But I think as far as the perspective is concerned, as to when you weigh up the good and the bad,
yes,
I think it really depends on who you speak to.
Right. And as a Euro-American, I tend to weigh in on the good side. You said you had a question.
Yes. So the question is, you know, in the 20th century, in the 21st century now, you know, I think our view has evolved further with regards to, you know, it's not, the world should not be at least as Darwinian as it was in Columbus's day. So I think the reevaluation that's going on makes sense. So I would like your view on that. I mean,
okay. Thank you. How about that, Jeffrey Simcox, the reevaluation, the revisionism of Columbus, and even the feeling of guilt about his discovery that we all profit from every day?
Well, the way we celebrate, the way we've celebrated Columbus has changed. Nobody celebrated Columbus until in this continent until 1792, and there was a little celebration
of Columbus as the creator of the new nation of the United States in 1792. An ode was written, toasts were drunk, a statue was erected. That was about it. Then comes 1892, 1893. At that point, thanks to Washington Irving and others, we're at the full flowering of what one might even call the cult of Columbus. And at that point, the whole message is European triumphalism, civilization being brought to a dark corner of the world. Fast forward to 1992, and what you have is a jarring confrontation of indigenous peoples calling Columbus a genocidal, homicidal person, and the rear guard of European triumphalists saying, well, he did great things, you know, and he brought civilization. Now, that's where the debate stands today. And if you look back to Las Casas, who's writing about Columbus in the middle of the 16th century, he is already well aware of the terrible contradictions in what Columbus had done. On the one hand, he praises Columbus for his courage. He sees, and Las Casas, as a Dominican priest, says, yes, you know, he did bring Christianity, but look at the human cost.
Look at the cost, yeah.
And essentially, the agenda that Las Casas set down for evaluating Columbus is still what we're trying to grapple with today.
Yes, at the Chicago World's Fair, the Columbus Exposition of 1892,
absolutely.
Benjamin Harrison, the president, called him Columbus a pioneer of progress and enlightenment. And in 1992, Berkeley, California, had a leaflet for its, I guess, school children that accused Columbus of grand theft, genocide, racism, initiating the destruction of the culture,
I mean,
et cetera, et cetera.
You couldn't have a more clear-cut opposition.
Yes, yes. And we're caught, really, between those two things. But are we in danger of throwing the baby out with the bath? I mean, is there – did the revisionism get to the ridiculous point where we, in Vargas Llosa's terms, were saying, well, maybe it would have been better off, and maybe the Incas and the Aztecs were McGovern liberals after all?
No, I don't think so. You know, they were a warlike, hierarchical society and pretty brutal. Point, just a small point of detail, that if Columbus hadn't landed in 1492, somebody else would have landed very soon after. The idea that somehow the Inca and the Aztecs and the indigenous people of the Americas could have gone on living in isolation is just not historically there. Sooner or later, a Breton or a Basque or somebody from Bristol would have landed and the whole damn tragedy would have started to unfurl.
And if they had horses, the Aztecs would have had their myths about these invincible beasts that would come out of the sea. Wasn't that part
of it? Yeah. But what we now discover from historical research over the last half century or so is how much the impact of European diseases changed the equation. And yes, the Spaniards were incredibly brutal. Yes, they exploited the indigenous people. But probably the more people died from smallpox and tuberculosis and other diseases that the Spaniards brought with them unwittingly than from warfare and oppression.
It was, as Alan Moorhead said about the Pacific Islanders, a fatal impact.
Absolutely.
Elizabeth Kohlberg, you point out that Columbus thought his discovery had been foretold by Scripture, but read the last paragraph of your article, which is a sort of another way of getting in Scripture.
Well, this goes back to Las Casas, who's been mentioned several times this evening, because he was, as we discussed before, himself a very important figure in Spanish colonial history, and I refer to him, quote him here, and it says, Columbus died on May 20th, 1506, by all accounts a bitter man. Las Casas saw a kind of justice in this, turning Columbus's theology against him, that is the theology that said that everything that he had done had been divinely inspired. He argued that this end, this bitter end, represented the will of God. Anyone who knows the history of Hispaniola, Las Casas wrote, quote, will be in a position to understand that all the misfortunes and adversity, grief and suffering that later befell him came about as a proper reward and punishment for the crimes he had committed.
So that was destined, if you will, and his misery in chains, his bitterness, was in some sense punishment for that. Thank you so much, Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jeffrey Simcox, a professor of European history at UCLA and the general editor of the Repertorium Columbianum, a multi-volume series on the documentary sources for the Columbian voyages.
Not at all.
Thank you. You can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a snapshot of American public opinion on war with Iraq. This is On Point. A recent ABC News Washington Post poll shows that over 60% of Americans support the use of force to remove Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. But fewer Americans support unilateral military action. Just 46% of Americans would support an attack on Iraq if U.S. allies were opposed to the action. On Point contributor Nate Dimeo took his microphone to the Arabian Nights-themed Aladdin Castle Casino on the Las Vegas Strip to see what players there were saying about the war with Iraq.
My name is Earl from Washington State. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I lost both legs. He's a bad man, and he's got to be reckoned with. Maybe I'm way off base, but I say let's take the $28 billion or whatever it's going to cost us to fight the war and put it on his head. Somebody to take care of it rather than see innocent people die. But a soldier isn't innocent. That's the job he chose. We're not a drafted army. We're a voluntary army. What war hasn't had thousands of civilians killed? You know, I don't like the idea. But on the other hand, what are you going to do? There is no answer to that. What are we going to do with them after we go in there and do that? You know, we haven't done anything in Afghanistan to speak of. You're going to have a United Nations in there to govern it until they get a stable government. No, the United Nations is a piss-poor operation. They don't do anything. They just talk. But I don't know what the answer is. If I did, I could be president.
My name is Judy, and I'm from Oklahoma. In Fort Sill, where it's a large artillery base, and my husband works in where they line up the computers to shoot the missiles. I'm so afraid they're going to send these young guys. And I see those youngsters marching, and it just breaks my heart. And I've known so many people, different ranks, colonels, generals, lieutenants. You're kind of torn. You don't really want to do it, but my goodness. I mean, I don't know how much longer I have to go, but I've got grandchildren and everything, and I worry about them. So many of them are 18, 19, and they probably don't have a clue what's going to happen, what's going on. They're not informed, and I think they really don't know.
My name is Asaf. I'm from Israel in the origin. I've been living here for 14 months. I live in Ramat Gan, which is on the border with Tel Aviv. I think that about Iraq, I think they should have done Saddam when they had the chance. People don't change so fast, and so I don't think there has been, like, he saw the light or, you know, anything that made him bend his mistakes. I don't see his people enjoying better welfare or better condition, or I think Bush is right, a more dangerous weapons building, more chemical. You can never know what goes inside his underground. He may have secret bunkers hidden in the desert. I mean, you'll never find them all. His people has been suffering for years. It doesn't seem like a person who cares about the people. Very dangerous person. You know, each day he gets more powerful, more. Yeah, I mean, they're worried about it. I actually been thinking if there's such a war, they're even sending my sister here.
This is from the Aladdin Castle Casino on the Las Vegas Strip, weighing in on a possible war with Iraq. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funding.